Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. We continue our series, Search for Solutions. Today we have two guests on two different topics. First is Lieutenant Colonel Gloria Sanders, who will talk about some problems in the care for our military veterans and what we can do about it. Our second guest will be Dr. Paula Ehrlich of the E.O. Wilson Foundation, here to talk about a bold new initiative to save planet Earth. We'll start with Colonel Dr. Sanders. Gloria Sanders is one of the leading physical therapists with expertise in prosthetics and has done great work helping our military veterans. Her education includes a B.S. in physical therapy from the Medical College of Virginia, an M.S. in experimental psychology and counseling from East Carolina University, and a doctorate in physical therapy from Simmons College in Boston, my hometown. During the Vietnam War, she interned at Walter Reed Hospital, where she worked with the Vietnam vets. When she was a professor at East Carolina University in the Department of Physical Therapy, she herself joined the Army Reserves, rising to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. She taught prosthetics in the Army PT program at Fort Sam Houston and served on active duty for Desert Storm at Walter Reed Army Hospital in Washington, D.C. In 1997, she retired from the Army, and she continues today to practice as a physical therapist, helping veterans and others for 50 years. Colonel Dr. Gloria Sanders, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you so much.
Well, you've had an amazing career, and first I want to thank you for all you've done for America and for our veterans. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
How did you become interested in the military, and why did you choose the U.S. Army in particular to join?
Well, my first internship as a student at the Medical College of Virginia was at Walter Reed Army Hospital. And since most of your listeners probably were not alive then, I'd like to just mention a few statistics to refresh everyone's memory. There were over 58,000 American deaths in Vietnam, and over 38,000 of those were Army. The average age at death was 23.
Oh, that's
over
awful.
Over 150,000 were wounded. Of those wounded, over 5,000 had lost limbs. They were amputees. And over 1,000 of those amputees had multiple amputations. So here I am, a 20-year-old going to Walter Reed and seeing all this devastation with people my own age. And I wanted to describe the dirty ward. There were double doors. You open the double doors, and there are 50 beds in this room.
Just to be clear, you're talking about the Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, D.C., back during the Vietnam War, like in the 1960s.
That's correct.
Yep.
You open the double doors into the dirty ward at Walter Reed. There are 25 beds down the right wall, 25 beds down the left wall, and nobody in the room has four extremities. And they are in Walter Reed Hospital about 10 days after they were injured in Vietnam. And, of course, we said the average age is 23, which means a lot of them were younger than that. After they were put in the dirty ward and their wounds were dirty, and that's why it was called the dirty ward, they later would take them to surgery and perform surgery to close the wounds and create a limb that was adequate for a prosthesis. Then there was the clean ward, another 50 beds. Same thing, young people, everyone in that ward was missing an extremity or more, one or more extremities. Then there was the rehab part. So my point is there were hundreds of amputees at Walter Reed at any one moment, and they were people my own age. So you can imagine the impact on a kid from a farm in eastern North Carolina seeing this as my first clinical exposure. It was profound.
Yeah, that must have been just horrendous to see that amount of damage to people. And for our listeners who may not know, Walter Reed Hospital has been in Washington, D.C. It was the Army's flagship medical center for over a century, from 1909 to 2011, and just closed about 6 years ago. And we're going to get to that, like why it was closed. But so this is the situation now of you, age 23, facing all these wounded Vietnam veterans at the hospital. That must have been very hard emotionally on you.
Well, it was stimulating but difficult. I mean, I saw things there in volume that most therapists might see one case in a lifetime, a whole career. Mm-hmm. So as a student, it was fabulous.
A lot of work to be done.
It was profound, yes.
Yeah. So being on this ward, then you wanted to do more to help the people there.
Well, I became so interested in amputations, first of all. And, of course, that wasn't the only major diagnosis. Head injuries was another huge diagnosis. There was a whole war just to treat people with head injuries. There were so many of those. So the volume was incredible. It was incredible.
And then you came back to Walter Reed when we had the Iraq War and Desert Storm, 1990-1991. So you're now coming back after having, you know, gotten more training, more education. You yourself were a professor teaching physical therapy and prosthetics. Now you're coming back maybe 25 years later. What did you experience at Walter Reed Hospital during Desert Storm? Was it similar quality care?
I was on active duty. I was a lieutenant colonel then. And the two experiences were incredibly different. The Walter Reed of 1966 was the top of the line medical care. The building was so clean you could have eaten off of the floor, I tell people. They had literal white glove inspections. They came in physical therapy with white gloves on, checking for dust. When I went back to Walter Reed in 1991, the hospital was filthy. The receptionist in physical therapy was so rude to patients. I walked up and told her, I said, if you were working in my clinic in North Carolina, you would be fired today and out the door. No one did anything. The prosthetic devices that were being used in 1990 were the things that we used in the 50s and 60s. The prosthetist who worked there was a civilian. New prosthetic devices came out in 1985, and from that forward, things made of graphite, people could jump and run, and wonderful devices. Walter Reed wasn't using any of them. So I told them, you can't do this. You must use the best that we have for our veterans, our military people who are coming in here. They banned me from the amputee clinic.
Oh, my goodness.
And I had been a guest speaker to their physical medicine residents there and to their staff, and they didn't want to hear it.
Wow, that's amazing.
The hospital was dirty. They were not up to date. Prosthetics was terrible. The whirlpool room where you treat wounds was not ready for mass injury. Entirely different place.
And what do you think happened over that 25 years where Walter Reed, from kind of the top of medical care, then when you came back, Desert Storm, 1990-91, it was in terrible shape. Why was it let to run down like that?
I don't know if it was the leadership. If I'd been chief therapist there, I would have whipped a few things into place. I don't know if it was privatizing so much. The military was cut back a lot over the years. Military used to take care of everything. They cleaned the grounds. They cleaned the hospital. They did everything. And when you privatize, then the military head does not necessarily have eminent control over civilians. So that could be a reason. I don't know.
Yeah.
Just attitude could be a reason.
Yeah.
There
well,
was a huge
and
difference.
We do know that in 2011, Walter Reed was closed. Did it continue to kind of decline in quality to the point where they had to close it because it was so bad?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. And I should say, Walter Reed is right in my neighborhood. I live about 1 mile away from Walter Reed, and they're now in the process of really, like, just knocking out all those buildings there.
Yeah.
It's just such
and
a shame.
And it was the best that the Army had. I remember asking the chief of my Army Reserve unit, who was a doctor. He was head of surgery at East Carolina University at the time. And I asked him, I said, how far behind a major hospital, teaching hospital, do you think Walter Reed is? This was 1990. Compared to Duke University Hospital or UNC Chapel Hill Hospital, he said 15 to 20 years behind.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you now yourself live near two military bases, Camp Lejeune and Cherry Point Marine Corps Base in North Carolina. How is the medical care there today for veterans in your area?
Well, if I speak in generalities, I don't think that will be quite as profound as if I give you a case study, sort of, and so people can hear specifics. So if I may, this patient went to the VA clinic in August of 2015 complaining of pain in his Achilles tendon, which is at the heel. 6 months later, he was sent for an X-ray. But he wasn't sent for an X-ray here in our county, where we have a civilian hospital, we have a naval hospital, and multiple places that people can, imaging centers and places where people can have X-rays. He was sent all the way to Wilmington, North Carolina, which is 60 miles one way, and this is a frequent problem. He was referred to my clinic in June. So that's 4 months after his X-rays were taken.
And your clinic now?
I asked
now,
to see his X-rays.
Where
he
is
was still complaining of pain in his heel. So
where is your clinic
X-ray
now?
X-ray disc, and I read it a few days later. I'm not going to tell you the profanity that I used over the.
but where? Tell us where your clinic is now. Are you at an Army clinic or are you at a university
this
clinic?
It's a private outpatient clinic, but it's in the same county as the Camp Lejeune Naval Hospital, and I'm in the same county as Camp Lejeune Marine Corps Base.
Okay, and so what did you see with this patient?
Well, when I looked at his X-ray, I saw a fracture. A big chunk of bone had been pulled off of the heel bone. And the importance of that is that if this chunk of bone is only pulled away a few millimeters, it's possible for it to heal without surgery. It can bridge the gap. If it's pulled away too far, then it can't bridge the gap, and one would have to have surgery to push the chunk of bone back where it came from and screw it back in so it could heal that way. So there's a clinical significance here and that it needed to be managed properly from the beginning. I was reading the February X-ray in the month of June. So I got the report that the doctor had, the radiologist had written for this fracture, and this is a person who is employed by the VA system, and he said there were no fractures. I sent the X-ray to an orthopedic surgeon who was on the faculty at Duke, and he confirmed what I saw. So I was so upset by this, I reported it in three different people. I called the local clinic that had never contacted him about his X-rays in 4 months and complained. I called the head of the VA hospital in Fayetteville, North Carolina, which is over the VA clinics in our county. And I called the local congressman's office. These were the responses. The local VA clinic called the patient. They never talked to me and told him I was not a radiology doctor and I should not have told him that he had a fracture. The head of the VA hospital in Fayetteville said, and I must say in a very diminutive voice, this radiologist is really not one of ours. We contract with him, and maybe we need to have a peer review. And the local congressman's office said, I sent the entire report with the x-rays and everything. They said, well, let's wait and see what Trump does.
Oh, this is disgraceful. And
it
meanwhile, here's a
and
patient.
And if this was a civilian case, it would be a lawsuit. I would love to be the lawyer on that.
Is it possible for a military
patient
to bring a lawsuit?
Says, Gloria, this person didn't hear about their x-rays in 6 months. I had an MRI done a year ago and have never heard anything.
Wow. And so what year are we talking about? Are we talking about, like, this is within the past year or so?
Yes, yes, this year.
Because we've been hearing,
this
you know, there was
year,
a lot of...
2016.
There was a lot of discussion of how the veterans care and the VA was, you know, subpar and long waiting lists and not great treatment, but then people were supposed to be on it and fixing it up and cleaning it up, and they're saying that it's in better shape now, but you're saying this is now present-day situation where there's
present
this kind
day.
Of very poor quality, even negligent medical care happening in our VA for our veterans.
It is awful. It is just terrible.
And are these isolated incidences?
Of these people. They get so upset, and they thought, you know, I go to war for my country, and I come back, and this is how I'm treated.
Mm-hmm.
It just, you know, they're just distraught over it. And I wanted to tell you, this is, I have a newspaper in front of me, our local newspaper, the Daily News from Jacksonville, North Carolina. The date is Tuesday, April the 18th, 2017, last week. Here's the headline. Veteran accused of assaulting doctor over alleged lack of adequate treatment. That was in one of these local clinics right here in this county.
Really? What's the date on that?
Last week.
Oh, my goodness.
April 18th, 2017.
Wow. So the level of treatment is so bad that the veteran is attacking the doctor because they're so frustrated.
Enraged. Yes. Yes.
And how
widespread...
Are these some isolated incidences, you know, a few kind of missteps, or do you see this as something that's very widespread and kind of endemic to the Veterans Administration even today?
Well, I just had my 50th class reunion at the Medical College of Virginia, and one of my classmates who's worked at Tufts for 35 years in Boston, she said, Gloria, our veterans get good care. Well, Boston has some of the best medicine in our country.
I'm happy to hear
that's
that.
That's probably true. You're from Boston.
Yeah, we're very proud of our medical care in Boston.
That's right. But all I can speak to is what they're receiving here. I don't know if it's nationwide, but I suspect that it is. I think it's a little better and a little worse here and there, but they're treated so disrespectfully.
This is really heartbreaking and infuriating that our veterans who put their lives on their line for defending our country, and then they have some kind of disease or medical condition they need help with, and they're not getting proper treatment, and they're being disrespected. This is outrageous.
Who should get the best medical care that our government has to offer?
Our veterans and our mothers.
If you take any group of people... Over the congressmen, over the senators.
Yeah. Well, what's really disturbing about what you're saying, in addition to the terrible care and the disrespect of our noble veterans, is that when you raise a concern about a particular case to the head of the VA down there and to the member of Congress, that they were kind of blasé about it and not taking the action that's needed to correct the situation.
Absolutely. And I've told people this. When I made the call to the head of the VA hospital in Fayetteville, if this person had said, thank you so much for telling me about this, this is not acceptable on my watch, I will take care of it and I will be back with you.
Exactly.
That wasn't what I heard.
Right. No, exactly, because any medical system, any human organization, really, there's problems will happen, and people
sure.
make mistakes. But the key is when it's brought to your attention that who's ever in charge just takes responsibility and takes action to fix the problem.
Right. I didn't hear that. And no, first of all, when I called, it was a week later that I got a return phone call, and my first call I said, this is a lawsuit. This is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And then I told the case. And, a week later I got a phone call, and since then I've never gotten a follow-up call of any corrective action.
Is it at all possible for a military veteran to bring a lawsuit against the VA for the treatment?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to it.
Yeah.
I don't think so. But I'm
yeah.
not positive.
Yeah, well, you know, probably not, else there'd probably be a slew of lawsuits right now.
Right. I think you're right about that.
So what can we do about this? You know, as citizens, our listeners are very active and informed members of our communities and our country. What can we do to help improve the care for our veterans?
Well, I think it has to come from the top. I think they have to be given authority to fire people when they need to. I've been told that you can't fire somebody that's working at a VA facility.
Uh-huh.
Well, then that breeds complacency.
Uh-huh.
So somebody has to have authority and use it.
Right.
People will normally rise to the level that you ask and demand.
Mm-hmm.
I found that in my own private practice. But if you get slack, they get slack. And if they know they can get away with something, they do. I guess it's human nature for
mm-hmm.
most people, not all people.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have their own internal barometer, and they're always going to do a great job.
Right.
But and maybe that's one of the downfalls of, quote, socialized medicine, when people don't have choices. But I fear, I heard recently that Trump just signed something that veterans can go to doctors of their own choice. Well, that sounds great, except are they going to pay properly and promptly? And I wanted to give an example. I'm a provider. I'm a healthcare provider. I have had a clinic here for 32 years.
Just before you go into that, I want to hear that about that experience as a provider. But just on your comment about the, you know, lack of choice and the, but bear in mind that was also true in during the Vietnam War. Is medical care provided, and it was that there was no choice. You went to the Veterans Administration, but it was really quality care there. Walter Reed was like fantastic, passing the white glove test, literally. But
right.
you know, something changed and something happened. So that's what we need to find, is like, where was that change, and how do we fix this? So go ahead, tell us the story of you as a provider. What's happening in some of your cases here?
Okay. Day before yesterday, I walk in my clinic, and my employee is on hold with her private cell phone. And I said, well, what are you holding for? She said, the Veterans Choice Program. And I said, how long have you been holding to talk with someone? She said, well, over an hour now.
And what is the Veterans Choice?
At 1 hour and 20 minutes, someone answered the phone. She told
Explain
me later that they usually have to hold between 3 and 4 hours to even speak with somebody, about non-payment for care that we gave months ago. And if you have 7 visits that you need to discuss with the person that you get on the phone, you're only allowed to talk to them about 3 visits. And then you have to hang up and call back and wait another 3 to 4 hours to talk about the next 3 visits. And then you have to hang up and call back to talk about the 7th visit.
Wow. And explain for our listeners, what is Veterans Choice?
It's one of the multiple options for veterans, and it's something sort of new. I'm not sure about the who qualifies for which type of veterans care. I can't answer that.
But it's basically, it's a program for veterans to call and get medical attention.
Yes, at civilian clinics. That's correct.
Yeah, and they're having now to wait, you know, sometimes 3 or 4 hours just to get someone on the phone.
And what providers are going to put up with that? You know, if you've got a really good doctor who's extremely busy seeing patients at Duke University, are they going to put up with having to wait 3 and 4 hours to discuss a claim? It's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I called my congressman's office that same day. They already knew about it. They've had lots of complaints about it. He could tell me everything I was getting ready to say. He said it for me. I said, what are you going to do about it?
Right.
And you can't get an answer. Who has the authority to do something?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's obvious. I don't know if the congressmen don't have the authority. I don't know the system.
Yeah.
I just know that it's bad.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like something that should be brought to the attention to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
And the head of the VA, the new head of the VA, needs to be briefed on all of this. And it all can be fixed. It just has to, you have to lay down the law.
Right. I think we should put you in charge.
Hold to it. And if people don't step up, then pack your bags. Go home.
Yeah. I'd love to put you in charge of the VA and clean. That place will be cleaned up in no time.
When I called the first time about this one case and sent the report to my local congressman, I said that. I said, put me in charge of these VA clinics in Onslow County. I said, heads will roll or it will improve.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
Yeah, somebody's got to. People
right,
are so
exactly.
mealy mouth about things and don't want to upset the apple cart. And, oh, I've just got this many more years and months to retirement, so I'm not going to say anything. And
right. That's a bad attitude. And, I so appreciate your service over 50 years, both in the military yourself and helping our veterans with their medical care. And that, by the way, congratulations on your recent Lifetime Achievement Award from the Medical College of Virginia. That's a big deal, and I congratulate you. So we're just about wrapping here. If you had a very brief comment to make as we're closing out, that would be great.
Well, I think the lack of good care for our veterans is a national tragedy. I think it's a poor testament to the heart and soul of this country. Every congressman, every congresswoman, and senator should be ashamed. What is this government thinking to treat these people so badly? In my opinion, they're getting third world country level care and with personal abuse. I am sick of seeing it as a military officer, and it breaks my heart.
Wow. Well, I really appreciate what you're doing, and we're going to try to get more attention on this issue and get some action. That's all the time we have. Colonel Dr. Gloria Sanders, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Our next guest is Dr. Paula Ehrlich, President and CEO of the E.O. Wilson Biodiversity Foundation, here to talk with us about a bold initiative to save planet Earth. Dr. Ehrlich has more than 25 years of strategic scientific management, research, and leadership experience. She was formerly president and CEO of the Drug Discovery Center of Innovation in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Dr. Ehrlich has a BS in zoology from Duke University, a master's degree in environmental planning from the University of Virginia, a DVM from the Virginia Maryland Regional College of Veterinary Medicine, and a PhD in bone physiology from the Royal Veterinary College, University of London. Dr. Paula Ehrlich, welcome to All Together Now.
Hi, Eleanor. It's really lovely to be with you.
Yes, I am so impressed with all your credentials and your great work you've done, and now you're leading one of the most exciting initiatives on the planet. For our listeners who may not be familiar with E.O. Wilson, can you describe who he is and what is the Biodiversity Foundation?
Sure. So E.O. Wilson, Edward O. Wilson, is one of the world's greatest naturalists and thought leaders of the last century. He's received more than 100 awards and accolades, including the National Medal of Science and two Pulitzer Prizes for nonfiction. He's what I think of as a poet scientist. So he's done extraordinary research, but he brings it to life through his writing. And he's really transformed his field of research, which is the behavior of ants, and then applied that scientific perspective and experience to better understand human life on Earth. Relevant to our work, he's been a pioneer in spearheading efforts to preserve and protect the biodiversity of this planet. And in 2006, the E.O. Wilson Biodiversity Foundation was launched with the mission to foster stewardship of our world through biodiversity research and education initiatives that would promote and inform a worldwide preservation of our wild and beautiful places. And so we believe that by helping people understand and appreciate the incredible diversity of life on our planet, that we can foster a culture of stewardship in which people are inspired to conserve and protect the natural world.
That is a fabulous description, and I love how you call him a poet scientist. That's a great description. And I heard him speak once at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., and I was very moved by his presentation. You know, he's a Harvard professor, scientist, naturalist, so he knows deeply his areas, his specialty and expert in ants. But he just has such a love of nature and of the creatures that he studies and of really the planet. And it's so moving to hear someone who so loves nature speak about that. And I just read his most recent book. He's got many books, but this new one on Half Earth, Our Planet's Fight for Life. And he talks in very moving terms about this mass extinction crisis. So he's saying, you know, we will lose most of the species of life on Earth within a century. So can you talk a little bit about where do we stand now in terms of this mass extinction crisis? How bad is it? And why does it matter to us humans if so many of these species disappear?
Well, for 3.5 billion years, Earth has been home to countless species. But sadly, human activity has led us to a sort of an existential crossroads. We're losing the natural world at an unprecedented pace. The rate of species extinction is actually about 1,000 times higher than at any time in Earth's human history. And so, as you know, that while we've dramatically slowed species loss, we haven't done enough. And that's why E.O. Wilson wrote Half Earth. He felt we needed to really change our conservation efforts from something that's been somewhat successful, a process. We've saved maybe 20% of species with that process, to a real goal, a goal to protect half the Earth and really stop our planet's mass extinction crisis. So if we can protect half of the land and sea, we can save about 85% or maybe more of the species that are left on the planet. In simple terms, the more the planet we can protect, the more species that we can save.
Yeah, that's a really ambitious goal. And part, what I love about the goal, this idea of, you know, setting aside half the Earth for conservation, what I love about it is it's the only thing I've heard that really is the solution at the scale of the problem, because we're experiencing this extinction of species all over the planet. The challenge that I see is that it's just so incredibly ambitious. You know, we now have about 3% of the oceans in preservation. But and I don't know what it is for the land, but you know, it's such a small amount that is currently in conservation. How are we going to get from the 3% ocean and wherever we're at now with the land up to 50% in the time we have? Like within this century, we could be losing all these species. So how are we going to do that?
Well, currently about 15% of the global land surface and 3% of the ocean surface, as you said, are protected in reserves. And really, half Earth will be a global, multi-sectoral, multidisciplinary, multi-stakeholder effort. To achieve that goal, it'll require research to better understand our world and care for it. We also are, through our Half Earth Project, which is bringing Half Earth to life, providing leadership to guide those conservation efforts. And really to engage people everywhere to participate broadly in the goal to conserve Half Earth. Our planet is a little-known planet in some ways, and we need to know a lot more about it. And so that's where our focus is in providing that research, leadership, and engagement.
Yeah, that's great. And you're right when you say it's a little-known planet in the sense that there's still so much we do not know about planet Earth itself. I was surprised in reading Half Earth, the book, that we don't even know all the species that live in Earth, and that at least two-thirds of the species that live here we don't know and don't have a name. And I thought, like I think many people do, that we kind of already have done Earth and now we're kind of off exploring the moon and Mars and space. But not true that there's, we think, 2 million species and we've only really hit the tip of the iceberg. And I love Dr. Wilson when he talks about seeing the exploring diversity, the biodiversity, and discovering and naming the species that are here as a great adventure for the next generation.
Yeah, it is. I think, you know, particularly when we're able to engage children, engage them early in having some sort of transcendent moment of discovery, where they see the world in a new way and they understand how maybe a discovery they've made may make a difference in the world. It seems to make them become the Earth stewards that we need them to be, the next generation stewards who will care for our planet. And to really understand the importance of those species to our own lives. Really, saving our planet's incredible array of species is important for our own physical and moral survival. Earth's biodiversity is really essential for human life. We depend upon nature for everything from medicine to clean water to food. And if we fail to protect nature, we ultimately fail to protect ourselves. And so it's really important that we understand what's there so that we know how best to care for it.
Right, and I think that's a really important point because so many people think, well, so, you know, we lose the white lion or the snow leopard and the Himalayas, and, you know, that's too bad, but it doesn't really affect us. And it's just so not really what's going on that
There was
imagine a world in which our children and grandchildren only knew elephants and rhinos and polar bears from picture books. I don't want to live in that world, and I'm guessing that most others don't either.
Right, exactly. Well, we definitely want to preserve that level of the species and viewing, for experiencing, for connecting. But also, you mentioned the medical piece, which I think is really huge, and that alone should be enough of a reason for people to say we really need to be protecting our species. There was a little bit of a throwaway line in the book that you could actually write a whole book about this, that much of the future medical practice might be kind of a kind of bacterial gardening, that there's so much bacteria, species and bacteria that are out there that we don't know much about. But some of what we do know is just critical to the health of humans. We have so much bacteria within us, and that whenever we have any medical or health issue, we want to be looking at how's our own bacteria doing and what's the bacteria out there that could maybe help us heal and be healthy and live longer. And that whole issue of the connection between biodiversity and strengthening and improving human health is just vital.
Right. And that is the concern, that there are species that are being driven to extinction that we haven't yet even identified. We don't know yet how important they are to our own human resilience, or could be to our human resilience if we understood them better, and how they could help with our medical care. It's kind of like a Christmas tree. There's all this tremendous biodiversity out there that's in a sort of a web, the web of life that supports us. And you don't know until you pull out maybe one of those keystone species how it might, like pulling a bulb off a Christmas tree, make all the other lights go out. So I think we just have to practice great prudence right now and humility as we think about our planet and need to care for the only planet that will ever be our home, that we don't lose anything. I think with, for example, climate change, if we all decided to, and we kind of know what we need to do, and we could put into place the various technologies or policies that would resolve the climate change crisis. But if we lose biodiversity, we can't fix it. It's gone. And so it's a super important thing for us to be focusing on as we think about how to best protect the only home that we'll ever have.
Right, exactly. Well, and, following up on this thing of the health and medical care, we mentioned the bacteria. There's also the herbs and plants, particularly in the rainforest, that we know for centuries it was the midwives that were using herbs and plants for healing and for medicine. And there's so many herbs and plants in the rainforest and elsewhere that could be used that we don't even know are there. So it's, we need to preserve, that biodiversity we preserve might be what helps you save your life someday.
That's right. And the pharmaceutical industry, the biotech industry, is continually identifying new plant species or mechanisms of action associated with diseases such as cancer that we can successfully treat with the bark of a plant or the leaf of a plant. It's sort of amazing. And it is a strong argument for protecting biodiversity, of course, because of its ability to inherently help treat unmet medical needs.
Yeah, and now we've got, so many causes of the species extinction. I love that acronym HIPPO of what's causing the species extinction,
right.
The habitat destruction, invasive species, pollution, population growth, and overhunting. How do we stop that? How do we prevent the species extinction, and how do we preserve the land?
Well, I think, you know, the core of the effort, and the core of the Half-Earth Project is science, and as we've been discussing, understanding, researching, and understanding our world. But I think inevitably the key to success is also going to be bringing in experts on population, sustainability and restoration, public and private conservation leaders, indigenous peoples advocates, biodiversity-minded economists, business people, philanthropists, your listeners, people, people that are eager to learn and take action to protect our planet. Inevitably, there's probably something that each of us can do within our own lives to begin to engage and think about this as an important part of our own lives, our own home, and part of our own holy grail in terms of how we think about how we live our lives and our relationship to the planet.
So what is your strategy to getting into the half-earth, to getting 50% of the land in the ocean preserved to save the biodiversity there anyway? It's a big reach. How are you going to get there?
Well, we're going to try to implement the research to better understand our world. We're sponsoring and supporting research efforts around biodiversity census, supporting university researchers and scholars who will be our next generation stewards. And then we're trying to provide leadership about exactly where we should conserve. There's lots of data out there around current biodiversity status, conservation priorities, and also human pressures. And by integrating those layers of data, we hope to be able to provide the leadership and understanding about what parts of the world to protect and why they're important. We're doing this through visually engaging mapping, where people can kind of get the global viewpoint, but also trying to develop maps or working to develop maps that zoom in on those places that allow us to see what's important to protect in our own local area or region and use that information for planning. Ultimately, that information can be used by private individuals in association with their own homes, governments, non-governmental organizations or conservation organizations, and hopefully provide leadership on what path is really the most where the most important places are to conserve in order to best preserve the biodiversity of our planet. And finally, I mentioned that we're doing a lot to try to engage people in this, to help them understand why it's important and why we need to do it. That's happening through some planned exhibits, films, concerts, a demonstration of model conservation efforts that can help people understand what's worked and what might work in their own neighborhood or region, and really trying to support and be sensitive to the unique socioeconomic needs of each particular region around the world in helping to develop and provide best practices for how to best conserve and address their conservation needs.
Yeah. Well, that's a full plate right there, and it sounds like a great plan. You've got this whole idea you mentioned as addressing the economic needs in each region. First of all, in terms of identifying the places, Dr. Wilson has done a beautiful job. There's a whole chapter in the Half-Earth book that talks about some of the, you know, really rich and biodiversity places on the planet. It is worth reading the Half-Earth book just to read that chapter. He's got such a sensibility, like you said, the poet-scientist there, such a sensibility about these areas rich in biodiversity and identify specific places. I want to go on a world tour now and visit all those places.
Amazing places. And if you'd like to get a better look at them, if you visit our website, the halfearthproject.org website, on the homepage, as you scroll down and learn about the Half-Earth Project, it lands at the bottom on a beautiful three-dimensional globe. globe that has all the best places on the biosphere mapped onto it. You can see where they are, and if you click on them, you can learn a little bit about them, see some imagery from them, and get a feel for where they are and why they're important. And so I encourage your listeners to go take a look. It's really a lot of fun to tour around and take a look. And that globe, then, you can spin it with your mouse. You can see what places are protected and other information about those areas. And that's sort of a prototype, then, for how we'll be building out the mapping information that I mentioned for about what we need to protect to get to half, and also how we'll monitor progress towards that goal in order to inspire people to participate and see that progress and get excited as we work towards the goal of half. It's a really, really important endeavor in the sense that it sounds nice, 50%, but it actually means something. It means that we'll be able to save the bulk of biodiversity, that we'll really have solved the extinction crisis if we can reach this goal. And after all, you know, we can do it. We are able to if we want to.
We can do anything we set our minds to. And I love that you have those sites on your website. I did not see that yet, but for our listeners, you want to go to eowilsonfoundation.org. It's a great website, and that'll save me having to fly around the planet to visit these great places. I'll just look at the cameras
and that website then points you to another website called halfearthproject.org, where you can really dig in on what the project's doing, all the various programs of the project, as well as our partners. It's a big job. And Half Earth, in its simplicity, is an idea that sticks and has tremendous momentum, and of course, in its execution, it's very complex and depends upon the partnership and collaboration of many, many organizations, which are listed on our website. But it's very exciting to see all of them, all of us coming together, convening towards this one goal. It's a pretty exciting moment and something I think we can lean forward on and feel very hopeful about.
Absolutely. And they talk about how inspiring it can be to have a big, hairy, audacious goal, and this certainly qualifies. You mentioned earlier about addressing the economic issues in each region. When you're moving towards preserving these areas of half the earth, I would assume most, if not all, of that land is, or and not the water so much, but the land has already a property owner. How are you going to convince property owners to stop doing what might be the economically beneficial thing, like, you know, rip down the rainforest and put up a cattle ranch? How are you going to persuade the owners of that land to move towards conservation?
Well, in the end, a lot of times conservation actually does have an economic driver. We know, for example, that the creation of new national parks in our own country can bring as much as, you know, $80 million of sustainable revenue to an area, not just around the important tourism industry, but everything else that surrounds that in our communities. And so quite often in places that are beautiful, they're pretty remote and rural. And so it brings a lot of economic advantage and drivers to an area. But also when I'm thinking about socioeconomic things, I'm thinking about a very important project in Mozambique, the Gorongosa Restoration Project, where that park was just devastated by a civil war, and it was going to be pretty difficult to reinvigorate that park without really sensitively thinking about the socioeconomic needs of the region, the kinds of schools and hospitals would be necessary to support the community so that it wouldn't feel compelled to poach and allow the wildlife to thrive again, and also to provide employment within the park to those who had expertise and insight into the wildlife there. And so in that situation, in a wonderful model conservation effort, you can actually see extraordinary progress for both people and planet in these kinds of conservation efforts.
That's fabulous. And you've got some star power on your side. I noticed that Harrison Ford is on your board, and
yes.
I'm wondering if he's really active and if you've met him. And also you've got Paul Simon doing a tour. So tell us about that.
Yes. So Harrison Ford's been a wonderful spokesperson for us, and he is a good friend of Ed Wilson's. Ed actually named an aunt after him, Harrison Ford.
Yeah. Oh, that's an honor.
So I have met him. He's great. And over the years, Paul Simon and E.O. Wilson have become very good friends. Paul read the book Half Earth and wanted urgently to do something. So he sits on our Half Earth Council, which is composed of a lot of thought leaders around wide-ranging fields of expertise. And this summer, he's graciously agreed to launch a concert tour to raise awareness about the extinction crisis and the importance of Half Earth. So I'm hoping that lots of folks will join us on this concert tour at 17 different cities in June and really take part in this incredible journey to conserve half the earth for the rest of life.
That's fabulous. I want to go to the concert. And what else can our listeners do? What should they go to the Half Earth website, or how can they help?
Well, definitely. Do come to the Half Earth website, because there you can sign up for our email list and learn more about all the different kinds of things that we have on the go. And really participate in this. What we are starting to feel like is a real movement culture of people who want to work together to help get us to Half Earth.
Wonderful. Well, that's all the time we have. I am so impressed with the scale and scope of the work you've taken on, and with such vim and vigor and vision and heart. Dr. Paula Ehrlich, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.